listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The sentencing phase in the trial of James Whitey Bulger begins in a little over 2 weeks. He was convicted in federal court this summer on 31 counts of racketeering, money laundering, extortion, and firearms possession, and the jury found him guilty on the participation of the murders of 11 victims. He's 83 years old, so Mr. Bulger is sure to spend the rest of his life in prison, bringing to an end a six-decade saga that is as much a story of the contradictory nature of loyalty, faith, and family as it is about organized crime and the insular world of Boston's Irish community. Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy are the authors of a book called Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. It was a New York Times bestseller when it was published in hardcover. Now it's just been released in paperback by W.W. Norton, updated with a new afterword. Kevin Cullen is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the Boston Globe. Shelley Murphy has covered organized crime since 1985, first for the Boston Herald, and since 1993 with the Boston Globe. And I'm very pleased to welcome them to our studio today. Hello.
Thanks for having us, Leonard.
A lot has happened in the story since your book was released in hardcover back in January, but perhaps you can discuss some of the larger issues and themes that run through it. What did Boston's Southie neighborhood mean to Whitey Bulger, and how did it shape him as the man he became?
I think Shelley and I said in the opening of the book that South Boston is literally a peninsula, and it is figuratively an island. People there think of themselves as apart from the city. In fact, people there call it the town. And so when you say, I'm going in town, that means you're going downtown. In Boston, it was just the opposite. You said, you know, we're in the town. And it really had a separate mindset. And one of the things that Shelley and I have argued that you know, in writing this book, we made South Boston a character. Because Whitey Bulger is much a story about time and place and social history as anything. And we argued that this story could not have happened in Hell's Kitchen in New York. It could not have happened in North Philadelphia. It could not have happened on the south side of Chicago. It's very unique to the town.
Even though those are Irish communities. But there are these ideals of loyalty, respect, reputation, and honor that are the backbone of Southie identity. How was it that Whitey Bulger subverted the very codes that he claimed to live by?
Well, I think in his own mind, he sort of justifies his relationship with the FBI. You know, as you know, he was a longtime FBI informant, but he says he was never an FBI informant. In fact, throughout his trial, even though it's not a crime to be an FBI informant, the one thing that he really wanted to try to convince jurors and the public of is that he never cooperated with the FBI, that in fact he used them, that he paid off agents for information. And I think, you know, he preferred the word analyst, strategist. You know, that the way he looked at it is he was the one that controlled them. They didn't control him. And so he justified that relationship.
Whitey's brothers, William and John, did well in school, and William went on to become the president of the Massachusetts Senate. How early in his life was it evident that Whitey was on a different path?
I think from a very early age. Shelley and I found that he dropped out of school when he was 14, and that coincided with his first arrest. And, the other thing that
what about his parents? Were they aware?
He obviously came from a very working-class background. His father lost an arm when he was a teenager in a railroad accident. And actually, you know, obviously there wasn't much of a market for one-armed laborers. So the family was very poor. The only reason the family lived in South Boston is because part of the New Deal, FDR's New Deal, was public housing. And this project was actually built in South Boston because of the young congressman that helped sell the New Deal, John McCormick, later to become the Speaker of the House. And John McCormick was from South Boston, so that was the quid pro quo. And the family moved in there. And so they grew up in this place where loyalty to family, to neighborhood, to neighbors was intense. And he learned that.
And he started with snatch and grab jobs just to make some money to get by. How did he graduate from that to armed bank robberies?
Well, I mean, Whitey did not like being poor, and he did not like working for a living. The way he made money is he took things, and he started hanging around the bar rooms around Southie, where a lot of these seasoned bank robbers hung out. And Whitey wasn't a drinker. He was really physically fit, but he was sort of mentored by these older bank robbers. And so he did graduate to bank robbery, and he was ultimately convicted in 1956 of a bank robbery spree that sent him to federal prison for a 20-year sentence, and he actually served time on Alcatraz.
How did he get caught?
He actually, you know, what we found fascinating in doing the research for the book is one of his accomplices was caught. And Bulger believed that he was fingered by one of his accomplices. And in return, what he did is he gave up a couple of others. And that really was the beginning of his relationship as something of an informant. And he gave up the names of others involved in these bank robberies in order to get leniency for his girlfriend at the time.
Now, this was what year?
1956. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison. He began in Atlanta. And very early there, he's trying to get a reduction to his sentence, and he allowed himself to be used as a guinea pig. And he was told—
In LSD experiments.
And back then, nobody knew what LSD was. He knew he was taking LSD, but that didn't mean anything. And he was told it was to find a cure for schizophrenia. Shelley and I found out, and we got a lot of detailed research on this, that there was actually a CIA project. And it was you have to go back to the Cold War, and they were struggling to try to find a way to engage in mind control. And the interesting thing we found out, you'd think they used prison inmates as guinea pigs, and actually it was more medical students throughout the country that were used in this experiment. But it basically induced psychosis in Whitey's case, and he really never slept well after that. He's always had night issues. He really became a nocturnal character because he didn't want to go to sleep.
Do you think that he left prison thinking that he would have turn his life around and go straight?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I saw letters that he wrote while he was an inmate at Alcatraz, and he was writing to his brother Bill, who became elected in Massachusetts while Whitey was in prison, and he was writing saying how he was determined to turn his life around. And we also found that he really educated himself at Alcatraz, and that he referred to Alcatraz the way many of us recall fondly our alma mater, and that he used to read a book a day at Alcatraz, and really sort of he studied Machiavelli, and he was writing to his family that he was tired of being the black sheep and really wanted to go straight.
So how long did it go straight?
We found he basically got back into the life after a year. He worked. His brother, the politician, arranged more or less a no-show job as a custodian at the courthouse because where else would you put a paroled bank robber but in a courthouse? And then he also worked construction. And we found that after about a year of that, he started really trolling the hoods, seeing where he could. And he landed with a group called the Killeens, who kind of ran the rackets in South Boston. One thing that helped for Whitey, when he was in prison during the 1960s, there was a horrible gang war in Boston, and about 60 men were murdered. And so a number of people that would have been his contemporaries and you would say rivals were either dead or in prison, which allowed him to rise very quickly in the underworld.
There are other aspects of the story. You talk about his reaction to the issue of forced busing in Boston in the mid-70s. What did he do to get his point of view across?
Well, you know, he was sort of, while his politician brother was an outspoken, opponent of busing, Whitey Bulger behind the scenes was wreaking havoc. I mean, he actually was involved in firebombing the John F. Kennedy birthplace in Brookline. And the reason for that is that Ted Kennedy was a very, outspoken supporter of the desegregation plan. And so at night, Whitey went through a Molotov cocktail through the window of John F. Kennedy's birthplace and then spray painted on the ground outside on the sidewalk, Bus Teddy. And he was very proud of these acts of violence. He also was involved in shooting up the Boston Globe. The Boston Globe was editorializing, in support of the desegregation plan. And he drove along the boulevard in front of the Globe and sprayed it with bullets. And then the following night, when all of the police were out, Boston police were guarding the front of the Globe, he was on the expressway, which runs on the other side, and fight into the newsroom. And we have actually obtained letters where he brags about this. He was quite proud of it.
He said he was very proud that the Globe had to go out and hire more security guards. He basically said that people that were hired because of him are now on pensions. He considers himself a job creator.
My guests are Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy. Their book, Whitey Bulger, was a bestseller when it was released in hardcover. Now it's available in paperback from Norton. So when did he become the head of the gang?
Well, this was, it was really his partnership with the FBI that allowed that to happen. He became a member of Somerville's Winter Hill Gang, and the hierarchy of that gang was decimated by a federal indictment for race fixing. They were paying jockeys to fix races, and because Bulger and his partner were both FBI informants, they were removed from that indictment, which allowed them to sort of move into the leadership position of that gang.
At the heart of the story is his relationship with the FBI agent John Connolly. Mm-hmm. And Kevin, weren't you the first journalist to raise questions about his relationship with the FBI?
Yeah, and that's specifically because John Connolly was my best FBI source. And after the mafia were decimated in the early 80s, it was pretty apparent, I covered organized crime then, it was pretty apparent that Whitey Bulger and Steve Flemmy were the dominant gangsters in Boston. Every time I'd ask John Connolly about Whitey Bulger, he would do two things. First of all, he'd try to dissuade me from writing anything about Whitey, saying he really wasn't that bad of a guy, and he actually, he was sort of a benevolent gangster, and he kept things. I lived in South Boston. And he basically said that he was sort of like this Robin Hood figure. But then the next phrase would always be talking about Billy Bulger. John absolutely idolized Billy Bulger. At one point suggested he thought that if not for his gangster brother, Billy could become the president of the United States.
Now, not everybody saw Whitey Bulger as a Robin Hood type. Michael Patrick McDonald wrote a memoir called All Souls about the impact that Whitey Bulger had on the area and on families like his brother Frankie, who was a four-time Golden Glove champion boxer, was allowed to bleed to death after he was involved in an armed car heist for the Bulger Gang. His brother Kevin was found hanging in his prison cell. His sister Kathy was paralyzed and brain damaged after she was thrown off a roof during a fight over drugs. And he said that that was not unusual,
no.
That the whole neighborhood was totally destroyed by the Bulger Gang.
There's a
and
lot
their
of
impact.
Denial. Michael's a friend of ours. And, I remember in the 80s when I was first writing stories implicating Whitey in drugs, Michael was one of the few people. He called me out of the blue. He was just a kid at the time. And he said, keep doing it. It's really bad here. And like I said, I lived in the neighborhood. And there's a lot of we talk about American exceptionalism. There's something called Southie exceptionalism. People in South Boston, with some reason, think it's the greatest neighborhood in the city. It's on the water. It's got all these things. But there's also abject denial there about criminality, about the problem, the scourge of drugs. Now, I have cousins from South Boston that were scourged by drugs. I lived there. There were drugs everywhere. And then people would tell me, Whitey keeps drugs out of the town. I said, you got to be crazy. I mean, there were families.
He was the person who was actually bringing the drugs into the
anybody room. That sold drugs, they had to pay tribute to him. But as we found out, Shelley and I found out, he had his own drug distribution ring. He was making
millions. And I think that, the trial, Whitey Bulger's trial this past summer was really vindication for Michael McDonald, because when that book came out, many people were saying, well, that's not true. And Bulger, did keep the drugs out of Southie, and the town was safer when he was there. But what we saw in the opening statements during Whitey's trial, his own lawyer stood up and conceded that he made millions upon millions from drugs. Proudly, he said that. And I think the reason he was so quick to concede that is he knew the evidence of Whitey's involvement in drugs was overwhelming, and that if he conceded the drugs, maybe the jury would believe him when he said he didn't strangle women and he wasn't an FBI informant. But even as Whitey admitted his involvement in drugs, he still tried to portray himself as this sort of good gangster, and his lawyer said, oh, he actually drew the line at heroin and angel dust.
What a guy.
He only allowed cocaine and marijuana.
A swell guy.
But he also denied that he had anything to do with the deaths of women, because that went against the code. And it turns out that's just not true.
Well,
is he just a liar?
Yeah, well, I think he's a fantasist. I think he's also very cute, as they say. Shelley and I found that throughout his whole life, he was very consciously constructing this benevolent wise guy theme, this mem. And when he was a young bank robber, when he had a car, when few people in the neighborhood did, he would use that car to drive around looking for old ladies who were trundling home with their bags of groceries and give them a ride. And then whenever anybody would say, oh, that's Jimmy Bulger, he's a hood, the old ladies in South would say, oh, Jimmy Bulger's a lovely guy. He just gave me a ride home from the market.
My guests are Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy. Their book, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice, has just been reissued in paperback with a new afterword on the trial, and it is published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy, the authors of Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster, and The Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. It's now available in paperback. It was a bestseller, a New York Times bestseller, when it was in hardcover. It has been updated with a new afterword on the trial. Let's talk a bit about informants. I mean, we already have talked somewhat, but they are a necessary evil at all levels of law enforcement. Are there guidelines that informants and their handlers must follow?
Yes, and they were routinely flouted by the FBI. In fact, what's very interesting here is that the judge who – there are very few heroes in that book, Leonard, but one of the heroes is a man named Judge Mark Wolf. He was the chief judge in the federal court in Boston. And in after Watergate, Ed Levy was the attorney general. And basically, Ed Levy's job was to bring some legitimacy back to the Justice Department after the Mitchell administration, you know, when John Mitchell was the attorney general. And Ed Levy's young assistant at that time was a fresh-faced Mark Wolf. Mark Wolf actually wrote for the Justice Department the guidelines on how to handle informants. And when he inherited this case, we talk about this case couldn't have happened anywhere but Boston at a time and place. I would argue in some respects, if not for judge, there are a lot of judges who would have taken a pass on this going up against the FBI. Judge Mark Wolf was not one of them. And so when he was looking at the way the FBI was flouting the guidelines with the informants, he knew that he wrote them. So he literally wrote the book. Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about Whitey Bulger as an informant. Another key figure is Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy. He was Whitey's henchman?
He was Whitey's partner. And the two of them, they were both informants, both killers, both gangsters. And Steve Flemmy had been offered membership in the mafia in New England and had declined because he realized it was much more profitable to team up with Whitey. And they met. And another thing that was very unusual is for an FBI agent to meet with, you know, two informants as a team. They were a team when they met with him. And Flemmy really was the one that knew more about what was happening in the mafia. And he and so Whitey sort of rode his coattails, because Whitey, what John Connolly would do is go back and then he would credit both Whitey Bulger and Steve Flemmy with this information about the mafia, which made Whitey Bulger, this Irish-American gangster, look like this, you know, prized informant with incredible information about what was happening in the underworld and the mafia, when in fact Steve Flemmy was really the guy. But John did this to make Whitey look more important than he really was, and he protected the both of them.
What were the stipulations on the part of Whitey or the FBI regarding this working relationship, and how long did it take Whitey to break the rules of the agreement?
Well, you know, the evidence at trial was that, you know, from the really early 80s, you know, Whitey Bulger becomes an informant in 1975. And by the early 80s, he's not only corrupted John Connolly, he's also corrupted John Connolly's supervisor, an agent named John Morris. And the two of them are taking bribes from Whitey Bulger. And so these FBI agents are taking bribes, they're leaking information. And, you know, and by the early 80s, Whitey Bulger and Steve Flemmy are suspects in numerous murders, including the murder of a millionaire businessman in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And yet, you know, the FBI in Boston is not sharing information with FBI agents in Oklahoma about these murders.
So his reach went far beyond the South Boston neighborhood?
That's what we find. One of our themes, I think, is that this is an epic tale drawn on a very small canvas. Whitey Bulger was the king of about a 6-square-mile area in South Boston. If you look at the map in our book, you can see everything is in a very relatively small. The farthest he went away was maybe 4 or 5 miles to bury his bodies. Once he left the confines of South Boston and got involved in national things, that's when it all started to come apart.
Because it's very territorial. The gangster world is very territorial. Was he impinging on other people's territories?
No, he was always intelligent enough to know to keep – in some ways, he was very gangsters tend to be incredibly greedy. He knew his limits. In fact, he said to Kevin Weeks, his henchman, who told us that he felt very uncomfortable. He said, we're going to lose everything because of this murder in Oklahoma, and he was right. And it took a long time because of the corruption of the FBI. The FBI was so invested in protecting Bulger that this thing took 20 years to really come out.
But by all accounts, John Connolly was moving up the ladder within the FBI. He must have been aware of the fact that this made him very vulnerable.
Well, John Connolly was this very sort of charismatic, gregarious agent. He was sort of this back-slapping agent. He was, you know, obviously he was from South Boston. He knew, you know, many of the political leaders in the city, including, of course, Billy Bulger. And he was the guy when the new head of the FBI in Boston, you know, they were constantly bringing in new people as the special agent in charge. And when a new agent would come in come to take control of the Boston office, he would bring them up to the State House. He would introduce them to Billy. He would get them tickets to sporting events, Bruins games, Red Sox games. And he also, John sort of knew everybody. And the other thing that John was very adept at was cultivating informants. And in the FBI, agents who are able to cultivate informants are, you know, they're the ones who are getting promotions and commendations. And John Connolly had informants, including Bulger and Flemmy, who helped build some of these big mafia cases in Boston that were so successful.
But this is not unique to Boston. We've heard of other FBI agents who have allowed criminals to engage in criminal activity simply because they were valuable informants.
Absolutely. And one of the things, Leonard, Shelley and I really wanted to show is the Justice Department has always spun this as one corrupt agent from the neighborhood who did this. Shelley and I really show that the corruption at the heart of this case really goes back to the 60s when Bobby Kennedy told J. Edgar Hoover, you've got to go after the mafia. They've infiltrated labor unions. They've infiltrated legitimate businesses. And up until that point, Hoover didn't even believe that the mafia existed. Now, I'm a little more strident on this. I'm a columnist. I can say what I think. I think under Hoover, the FBI was institutionally corrupt. And the idea that they went after the mafia on the grounds that they could use Irish-American gangsters who were somewhat less dangerous, that's baloney. In Boston, the Irish guys were worse than the Italians in terms of lethal ability and numbers. And so the corruption began. We showed that the FBI in the 60s decided who won those gang wars, that they got people killed. They set people up to be killed. So the corruption is endemic.
Well, the FBI was more interested in finding communists and
exactly.
proving that Martin Luther King Jr. was a communist than it was in finding out about the about the mafia and other criminal activities. What crimes was John Connolly ultimately convicted of?
Well, right now he's serving a 40-year sentence in Florida for murder. He was convicted of being involved in this plot where he leaked information. He warned Bulger and Flemmy that a businessman from Boston named John Callahan was being sought for questioning by the FBI. And the fear was that he would implicate Bulger and Flemmy in the murder of Roger Wheeler, the Tulsa businessman. So there was this plan where Callahan was lured down to Florida, and this hitman working for Bulger and Flemmy killed him. And so John Connolly was convicted by a jury in Miami of that in 2008. And at that time, John was already serving a 10-year sentence, having been convicted in Boston of racketeering in 2002. And at the heart of that case was that in late 1994, as, you know, other investigative agencies in Boston, the DEA, the Boston police, the state police were targeting Bulger, Connolly warned him to flee in December of 1994, allowing him to, you know, evade arrest. And he became one of the FBI's 10 most wanted and was on the run for 16 years.
Well, given the nature of his work, Bulger always knew that there was a good chance he'd have to leave Boston with little notice. So had he prepared for that day?
Oh, yes. He had several contingency plans. He stashed money in different parts of the country. He stashed
money
overseas. He had boxes in Dublin, London. He knew that that day of reckoning would come. And that's there's one thing, according to John Morris, the corrupt supervisor, he asked John Connolly, what did these guys want, meaning Flemmy and Bulger? And he goes, all they want is a head start. They want to be tipped off when eventually this day happens.
Well, how many identities did Bulger have over the course of his 16 years on the run?
Well, what's interesting is when he fled in late 1994, he had one really good alias, Tom Baxter, with an address of Selden, New York. And this was an address that he had, an identity that he had cultivated years earlier, and this was the identity that he planned to use during his life on the run. But he made the mistake of crossing a girlfriend, a scorned woman. He had two women he was juggling at the same time, and one of them, who he initially went on the run with, Teresa Stanley, did not want to stay on the run with him and said, take me home. She had found out he had been cheating on her for years. She ultimately, like a year later, she tells the FBI he's using this name, Tom Baxter, and he had been hiding out in New York. They're able to use that alias to track him to Louisiana.
Now, they had established a kind of a traditional family setup.
Right. I mean, so by then, you know, they came very close to catching him in Louisiana. But now Teresa Stanley felt a little bad about giving up his identity. She tells Whitey's friend, look, I've given the FBI his alias. And the friend quickly warns Whitey. And now he and his girlfriend, Catherine Gregg, are on the move again. And he was very ingenious at how he was able to get new identities, where while they were hiding out in California, he would go to homeless people and pay them money for their IDs. And he recruited a couple who looked just like him.
How much did Kathy Gregg know about Whitey and his relationship with Teresa, and also the fact that he'd played a role in the killing of two members of her extended family?
Well, we have a very dramatic confrontation when Kathy knew about Teresa, but Teresa didn't know about Kathy. And not long before Whitey had to flee, Kathy actually approached Teresa Stanley, asked her to have a meeting, and then told him, I've been with Jimmy, as they would call him. I've been with Jimmy for 20 years. You didn't even know that. And so, and then Whitey finds out that the two women in his life had finally found each other. He comes in out of the blue and says, we're out of here. And he was so angry at Kathy, he began to strangle her. And Kevin Weeks, his henchman, who was actually a great boxer and a professional bouncer, if he wasn't there, who knows what would have happened. But he tore him off, and then that's it. And so he tries, that's when he takes Teresa on a whirlwind tour while he's storing money here and there. But, you know, we don't know how much we do believe that Kathy had to be, if she's from Southie, I knew that Whitey was implicated in the killings of people that, first of all, the brother of her husband, Kathy's husband, was killed. And then another brother was killed. So these are two of her brothers-in-law that were killed allegedly by Whitey. Actually, the jury convicted him of killing Polly McGonigal. And it's not a question I would say direct to us. I would direct it to Paul McGonigal's son, who was a witness at the trial, and Shelley and I know quite well. And Paul really believes that she knew all of this, and yet she loved this guy. One thing that's very clear to me is that Kathy really loved Whitey Bulger.
Well, during the trial, his lawyer claimed that Bulger was of Irish descent and therefore would never act as an informant against
people. I laughed out loud at that.
But he also, Bulger said that he would never kill a woman, although he wasn't convicted in the death of Steve Flemmy's girlfriend, Deborah Davis. He was found guilty in the death of Deborah Hussey. But it's obvious that he was involved with both of those killers. Why was that claim so important to Bulger?
Well, I think it goes back to Whitey Bulger trying to cultivate this image, you know, this perception that he was this gangster with scruples, that he was a good, bad guy. And good, bad guys don't strangle women, and they don't rat on their friends. So it really came down to reputation. And even now, as he sits in jail awaiting his sentence, he's writing letters to people saying, oh, these are all lies. And, you know, he swore he would get up at his trial and refute the lies. And, of course, he never did testify. But he's very, he has tried to convince people that he's just this really nice guy, and he's really tried to dehumanize his victims. Even now, he's writing letters saying, well, you know, I didn't kill Deborah Davis, but she was not really that nice of a person. I mean, he really tries to smear the victims.
My guests are Shelley Murphy and Kevin Cullen. Their book, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice, was a New York Times bestseller when it was issued in hardcover, and now it's been released in paperback with a new afterword on the trial. Well, how was he able, despite being near the top of the FBI's Most Wanted list, to live a somewhat public life on the beach in Santa Monica for over a decade? He actually wound up on the top after Osama bin Laden was killed.
Well, one thing we tried to show in the manhunt section of the book is that the first 2 years, the FBI was not looking for him. The FBI, in their wisdom, assigned the search for him to the very organized crime squad that he had corrupted. They were the last people on earth that won. Now, Shelley mentioned that, you know, that they talked to Teresa Stanley about an alias, and she did give him the alias. The part we found out is that the FBI did not interview her for 14 months after Whitey took off. She had been, I saw her around Southie all the time. They never spoke to her because once they did, they had a real lead on it. If they had interviewed Teresa Stanley when she came back, they probably would have been able to capture him. Now, there was a lot of pressure on the FBI, I would say most of it coming from the pages of the Boston Globe, saying this is not right. And when they finally brought in multi-agency task force, the trail had gone cold, and he had set up his... The guy was living in a rent-controlled apartment two blocks from the beach in Santa Monica.
You know, and the other thing, though, is that, you know, Whitey had grown a beard, he wore a hat, and frankly, he looked like so many other men. I mean, the FBI was getting tips from all over the world. They really did believe that he was in London in 2002, and that caused the, you know, much of the manhunt to shift overseas, and it wasn't until he was captured in June 2011, living just a couple of blocks from the beach in Santa Monica, that we discovered the only time he really left the country was to drive down to Mexico and go walk over to Tijuana and buy medication for a mild heart condition that he had.
And so, then come back into the country.
And then come back into the country.
He had millions, but he was cheap.
How did you come into possession of the jailhouse letters that he wrote after his arrest?
Well, I actually obtained those from Richard Sunday. Now, he is a man who served time with Whitey Bulger in both the Atlanta prison and in Alcatraz. And Whitey had reached out for him while he was on the run looking for fake identities. And Richard had said, sorry, you know, can't help you. And by the way, I saw you on America's Most Wanted. So after Whitey was captured, I talked to Richard and interviewed him on numerous occasions just about, you know, trying to piece together what Whitey was like as a young man and the time they did in prison. And he started writing to Whitey after his capture. And he shared the letters with us to give us an idea of what kind of person Whitey is. And he was actually very supportive of him and considered him a friend and wanted to show us this other side of him. Because, of course, in these letters, Whitey is writing, oh, you know, Kathy Gregg was the love of my life. Our 16 years on the run were like a 16-year honeymoon. And he also claimed that he had offered to plead guilty to all the crimes he was charged with if they would only let Kathy Gregg go. And he was furious when Kathy Gregg was sentenced to 8 years in prison because he said they should have given her a medal. She did what no law enforcement person could ever do, and that was keep me crime-free for 16 years.
Kevin, you recently wrote a column in the Boston Globe about the power of denial and how the Bulger family, especially his brother Bill, enabled Whitey's life of crime by continually supporting him, continually turning a blind eye. Has Bill Bulger spoken publicly about his brother's conviction, and has he talked to you at all?
He's not, and I think I'm persona non grata with him. It's ironic because I was very defensive of him over the years. He was not a favorite in the Globe newsroom, and he's very dismissive of the media in general. But I found Bill a sort of a man of principle when it came to his politics. He stuck up for working people, and that was good by me. And Shelley and I asked him to cooperate with the book, and he would not. But I know that a friend of his told me that he really did not like that piece I wrote, because I ended it by saying, the one thing we will never be able to answer, that question is, if Bill Bulger, who did so much to get his brother out of prison and genuinely believed his brother wanted to go straight, what if Bill Bulger, after learning that he was back in the life of crime, turned to him and said, as long as you're in that life, you can't be in ours? And we'll never know the answer to that. Personally, I think it could have been the one thing that would have pushed Whitey away from a life of crime. I don't believe Whitey could survive without the succor of his family.
After the sentencing on November 13th and covering the story for so many years, are you and your readers ready to move on?
Man, I am. I want to write a book about hockey.
We had Bobby Orr on the show recently.
He's the best.
That was
awesome.
A great thrill. The book that we've been talking about is Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. It was a New York Times bestseller when it was released in hardcover, now in paperback from W.W. Norton. And my great thanks to Kevin Cullen, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the Boston Globe, Shelley Murphy, also with the Boston Globe now.
Yes.
And it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks, Leonard.
Thank
this
you
was
very
fun.
Much.
I really enjoyed
this.
It.